So now we'll move into the question and comment phase. And unfortunately, because it looks like we're dealing with a crisis of resources, we only have one microphone. So, you know, we're going to, be the future we want and limit our destructive capacity. So what I'd like to do is ask people to please come up, line up, and I'll bring the microphone down, and we'll take a number of comments. You can ask a question of one panel or all the panelists, whatever, and let's also do this as a progressive stack, so that we have people of all genders equally represented. So if you want to just come up here, form a line here, and I'll bring the microphone down.
Okay, I'd like to make my comments directed at Doug. Hi, Doug. I'm Basia. I think with your comments with the march and 350.org and what it's trying to accomplish, you're really missing the point, okay? Because, well, for example, I'm part of the faith contingent. And to tell you the truth, I'm really an agnostic. But the faith contingent and myself, we share, with the faith contingent, I share a love of humanity and the love of the earth itself. And like Ms. Piven was talking about the movements, like, for example, the civil rights movement. The reason the civil rights movement succeeded is it because it made discrimination a moral abomination. And what we in the faith contingent, and it's not for nothing that Bill McKibben's a Methodist Sunday school teacher, we are going to make the burning of fossil fuels a moral abomination. And by the force of our will and the sway of public opinion, we are going to win. And we're going to transition to renewables. And we're going to retrofit all buildings for more efficiency, and we're going to separate agriculture from fossil fuels, and we're going to win, and I have confidence that we win. Because 3 years ago, when I got arrested in Washington, D.C., there was not a doubt in my mind that that pipeline was going to be built. I was sure it was going to be built, but I was not going to let it be built without raising my voice. And I did, and much to my surprise, it hasn't been built yet. So that gives me faith in the future.
Oh, we're asking the questions first, and you're not going to take time to answer. Okay. Okay, well, first, I'd just like to start by thanking Francis, because, back in the 70s, it was your book, it was you and Saul Alinsky, got a lot of us started in the careers and the paths that we've taken since, and we made a bit difference back then, I think. I happened to do that up in Tompkins County, New York, where I'm now on the legislature, and I think that it's pretty clear to me then and since that we need all of the things you're talking about, that we're not going to make changes, that we need change addressing climate, we need change in the political systems and true democracy that truly gives power to people. We need change in the whole market approach. But none of that is, that's not all going to happen overnight, and it certainly isn't going to happen if we say we have to wait for one or the other to happen first. And so what we've done where we live is to take the pieces that we can impact and figure out how to build the social movements, how to involve an ever-increasing number of people in understanding any aspect of this, and putting all those all together. So when the threat of fracking came to us, we said, okay, is it true, the assumption that if we only risk our environment, we get more jobs, we get more money? And we found, lo and behold, that when you really ran the numbers, you look at the Pennsylvania Department of Labor statistics, and it says that the jobs aren't really going to Pennsylvanians. 96% of the checks are being sent out of state. Okay, they claimed, the industry claimed 45,000 jobs in 1 year, and it turned out permanent, long-term, local jobs, 3,000. So we used those numbers and built coalitions of farmers and activists and, you know, local politicians saying, okay, this, what are the assumptions true? So I just want to, you know, look for sources. So I guess the question I have for each of you is, if you accept that, if you accept that, yeah, in whatever realm you're advocating that we work in, what do you recommend that people take from here, from tomorrow, and go back to home communities and do, and not tell each other, no, it only has to happen on the national level, or no, it only has to happen on the local level, but realize that you take your piece, but it... you know, it has to happen everywhere. So what would you recommend that we go back and do? Throw out some ideas for us. Thanks. And resources.
Hi, Arun and Francis. You're the ones I know. I'm Nancy Holmstrom. I work with System Change on Climate Change and various other groups. When I saw that, I agreed with a lot of what you said, but when I saw the title of the session, and when I saw the book that some of you were involved with, I was really perplexed and frankly somewhat annoyed. And the perplexity was, who on earth is this addressed to? Because this is a left audience. Anyone who reads that book is on the left. So who are these apocalyptic now folks, the catastrophists? There are Marxists, okay, ecologists, there are eco-socialists, they call themselves, like John Bellamy Foster, like Richard Smith, like Chris Williams, like Michael Lowy, like Joel Covell, etc., who simply are following what the scientists have said, that it's getting worse and worse and worse, but there are various tipping points, okay? And there's only so much time, and it's getting worse and worse and worse, particularly as capitalism has taken over in the largest, most dynamic country in the world, namely China. So it's only going to get worse. Now, none of these Marxists, including Karl Marx, ever counterposed that analysis of capitalism and its suicidal tendencies, eco-suicidal tendencies. None counterposed that to working for reforms. Okay? None. Okay, all the kinds of things talking about doing, such as being here, and all, you know, all kinds of things. It's not counterposed. So who on earth are you saying, you know, are you addressing this scolding, hey, get involved in the movement? They are. We are. So I don't get it.
Cool. I just want to say thank you. My name is Nick Powers. I found useful, Arun, your emphasis on social organization as the key to understanding climate change rather than just a hard materialist political economy. So with that in mind, rather than the apocalyptic imagery driving people through panic or fear, are there utopian elements of possible somewhat functioning society post-job, post-labor, which I think you mentioned, that could be highlighted now so that people can begin assembling pieces of a positive vision that then could be discourse alongside the apocalyptic imagery for our social movement? That's it. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Dave Schwab. I'm here from Madison, Wisconsin. And since I believe all the speakers mentioned basically a social movement or political demands rooted in social movements. So I'm very curious to hear your thoughts about the potential of the Green Party and independent anti-corporate politics in general that is independent of the corporate two-party system. And the Howie Hawkins for governor campaign specifically.
Can you keep going?
So after you, we'll go back to us.
Okay. Okay, great. My name's Lucy. I just wanted to address what I think is a tension in the panel of the comments being raised about sort of this idea of should we be calling for a radical transformation of capitalism, or do we need to be focused on, you know, specific reforms in the immediate sense that are achievable in the here and now? And I just want to say that I don't necessarily see a contradiction between those two things. I also think there's a tension in Doug's comments in particular, and some of the stuff Christian Parenti has raised about also, you know, whether we're calling for a whole attack on capitalism or whether we should be calling for the state to actually intervene. Again, I don't see a contradiction in these things. I think actually by building both an independent movement like the Green Party, like the Howie Hawkins campaign, but also by building a radical socialist movement actually is the best way for both of those ends. And I'll just say that, you know, I'm a socialist. I'm also a union member. And I think that, you know, when you're talking about what are the institutions that should be fighting for working class demands that actually should be at the forefront, I think the unions are obviously, you know, they're the main institution of working class organization that has the interests of its members in mind. And I think that you know, how are we going to actually transform? And you know, a number of unions have supported this rally, including mine, which is really great. Other unions have taken not such great stands on the environment. But actually, you know, when you talk about a radical transformation of society, it's about working people actually having staying control over their workplaces, over society, over their institutions. And I think we need to build those movements within unions themselves. And I think we need radicals, independents, et cetera, fighting for those networks within unions and within other social organizations to then even be able to talk about, you know, how do we get these institutions to fight for the kind of state intervention that it's absolutely going to be necessary in order to, you know, save us all. So, not to be catastrophist.
So we'll just go down the line, and we'll start with Doug. But I want to do a quick little audience poll in regards to Nancy's question, who are we talking to? Folks are familiar with James Hansen's comment, right, about the Keystone XL pipeline, game over. If it's built, it's game over for the climate. It's that done. Are people familiar with that comment? Okay. Now, how many of you think, so we know that for 20 years there's been these alarm bells about global warming crisis since the Rio conference, when was that? It was like 91 or 92, this has been going on over 20 years, and yet the rate of greenhouse gas emissions, ecological destruction all continue to increase. How many people think that if the present trends just continue, that it'll be game over in 10 years? That, in other words, we'll have gone past a tipping point of total planetary destruction in 10 years. Raise your hand if you think. Yes, continuing on the present path. Do you think there are a lot of people, I know a very prominent progressive economist who says this, if we don't do something within 10 years, it's all over. How many people believe that? How about 20 years? Okay, that's who this panel is aimed at, right? Because I think the idea that we're going to change the system of capitalism and carbon economy in 20 years is incredibly optimistic, phenomenally optimistic. I wish I could be that optimistic. I just don't think that's going to happen, but I'm going to pass it down to others.
No, but Arun, as I understood, one of the reasons that that you're trying to sort of create a barrier to catastrophic predictions is that you don't think catastrophism encourages movements, encourages activism. Everybody here is here for the climate march, right? These are the activists.
No. It's not. Sorry, it's not about encouraging activism. It's it's not about that it doesn't encourage activism. I mean, that is one argument. I know that's an argument in the catastrophism book. It's that it argues like for shortcuts that we can get from here to there in one great leap. And there are people who, that the time is now, we need to do something immediately. If we don't do something immediately, then it's all over, right? You know, and it's just like, unfortunately, the forces arrayed against us are so phenomenally powerful, you know, and without getting into a tangent, like, I wrote something on Counterpunch that I know a few people have seen, in terms of how the movement itself is to a certain degree being co-opted into the Democratic Party, which is one of the wings of Wall Street, right? The march tomorrow, and I told people, I encourage, be out there tomorrow, be out there on Monday, but don't have any illusions about the power of the forces that we are up against. They're incredibly powerful, and you know, we can talk about whether this is the energy industry or capitalism, but they are intertwined. There is no energy industry without heavy machinery, without the agricultural sector, without the transport sector, without the banks, without chemicals. So in terms of what we're trying to oppose, we're opposing these vast sectors, and we're not going to be able to change this in the relative blink of an eye. And there is also an argument about the catastrophism that will happen is also going to play out over the scale of many decades and centuries. So we have to take the long view in both ways.
Let me start just by reacting to something Arun said, which was all these other sectors do are substantial, but you know, machinery, et cetera, could do business as well with clean energy. So the real problem is, the core problem is the carbon sector, and taking on the rest of them seems rather ambitious at the present moment. I am not a Sunday school teacher, and will never be, and I have only bad memories of the nuns in my childhood, so I react allergically to Sunday school talk. This is not a moral fight. I really I have serious problems with the moral language. To quote some old fellow from the 19th century, between two opposed forces, there's no right and wrong, only might prevails. And in this case, we're talking about social movements developing the power to disrupt business as usual, as Fran always says. That's what we need. We need power, and preaching is not going to get us that kind of power. We need people who will get together and f- things up, basically. Make it business as usual not possible. My problem with the language of it's only getting worse, it is only getting worse. And if we do nothing, it will continue to get worse. But on the other hand, like, that will just drive people up. You're not going to get people off the couch with that kind of language, I'm afraid. It's just going to say, what can I do? You know, that's not what we need. We need something somewhat a more hopeful, transformative message. I don't think there's any opposition in this case between reform and longer-term social transformation by changing the way, by having the state force the changes in the way we do business, that is stepping on the freedom of investment of the capitalist class. They understand that, and they're not going to like that, but it does have to be done. And as far as the language of utopia, you know, I'm really very underdeveloped in that area, and I need to work on that. I think that's an absolutely important central point. I think we need more of the utopian language and less of the disaster language. You know, no one's yet, you know, quoted Slavoj Žižek's remark that it's easier to imagine the end of life on Earth than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. It's true, and we need a little bit of that utopian spirit to return. And what, you know, since I'm really not really developed at in my utopian thinking. I can't offer too much detail, but I think we can offer a future of where there's less fear, less alienation, less of a sense where we exist in competition with each other at all times, less alienation, less instability. You know, a world of you know, more humane and connected world. And since you know, the carbon economy is at its very base destructive, I think the transformation of that from a carbon base to a renewable, clean energy base would create, to some degree, a material basis for a different way of thinking of the world. That in nature, years ago, Business Week did this. It was actually McGraw-Hill, which was then Business Week's parent, had an image of the Earth cut in half, being squeezed over a citrus squeezer, And that was their idea of the approach to nature. It really stuck with me at like 20, 30 years ago. And, you know, that is the kind of consciousness, you know, this carbon-based extractive society creates. And the utopian vision would be moving away from that towards something that's not destructive, that's but constructive, something that's not competitive, but solidaristic and connected, and something that is less motivated by anxiety and fear, and something that's more motivated by hope and, you know, love even.
So why? That was great. That was great, Jared. But why? I mean,
I'm practicing.
But why? You're doing good. I think you can do this. Movements. I think great movements always have a kind of underlying moral conviction, and when they sing those songs are about love and hope and a better world and treating men and women and cats and dogs and monkeys as good creatures that we need to have with us. So I think that it's okay to talk about morality, and movements always talk about morality. I do think that a really important question for us to discuss is, what should people do when they go back home? Because, you know, I love marches, but a march is just a march. Everybody goes home after the march. They pile into the buses. Everybody knows that the authorities know they're going to pile into the buses and go home. The carbon industry executives know they're going to pile into the buses and go home. So the really important question is, what are we going to do tomorrow in our everyday life, on our weekends, on after work, or maybe at work? Can we talk about that? So we talk to other people, we call meetings, but shouldn't we do local actions too? Yeah. So what kind of local actions? Are there people here who have been involved in local actions? Against, tell us. Can we form a line on this? I don't want to take your role or run. You do it so well. Is that okay? Okay, let's hear about local actions.
Can you take the mic?
I don't know. This is kind of like a weird situation of acting locally, but also thinking globally. I'm Ukrainian American, and I teach English as a second language at Virginia Tech in Southwest Virginia. And, you know, through people that I'm in contact with in Ukraine, there are 20,000 internally displaced people in hospitals in Ukraine, but also within the permaculture movement. I'm a permaculture person. We've kind of created this organization called Permaculture for Peace. So every single Saturday we have Shed Talks, which are our alternative to TED Talks, but they're focused on sustainability. And on Sundays, we have Sustainable Sundays. It's called permacultureforpeace.org. That's the number 4. And so I have students from every single continent sitting at this round table in this shed, and we introduce and discuss different practical topics in permaculture, and then it's being streamed into hospitals in Ukraine and translated into Ukrainian, and we're also translating it into Creole, and based on where it is we are invited, we're going to continue to do these things. So there's this hands-on, you know, application in terms of including people from different backgrounds, sharing different perspectives on these ideas. We have like a 45-minute session, and it's all people learning English as a second language. That's the lingua franca. And then we have like an hour of hands-on activity. And we're videotaping this, and this is all just like with laptops and iPads and Google Hangouts. And so there's this local action that's inclusive, and people from different backgrounds taking the lead. But then it's also being streamed abroad to different places. So I don't know, that's what we're doing, Permaculture for Peace. .org with the number 4. Anybody else want to share?
Anyone else? Local actions? Come tell us.
Hi, I'm Pat Albright, and this is Carolyn Hill with the Global Women's Strike. And we have our colleague, Eric Dirtson, in the back there, who's with Payday Men's Network that works with the Global Women's Strike. And I wanted to preface this by saying to Frances how much the work that you and others like you and the welfare rights mothers in the 60s did, how critical that work was, and it will come into focus. We're sure in as time goes on, it will be more appreciated. And what I'm about to say really it builds on that work, and that because what we're proposing and working on is an international campaign and a petition, which we'll be finalizing soon, to call for a living wage for mothers and other carers internationally, and that on a U.S. level, in which we also work on locally, is we're working to get support for a new welfare bill in Congress called the Rise Out of Poverty Act. That would change the whole way that welfare is seen and welfare mothers are portrayed. And I had been on welfare myself, and it's in the way that mothers are under attack. It's an attack on the movement here, the attack on the and it. We want to wrench money from the market and in the war, in the military budget. And so we're urging people to support this bill, which is a way to start to to bring back our entitlement to resources, by making ending child poverty the goal of welfare policy. And also, it would begin to allow us to have the, once again, to allow mothers on welfare and those the welfare mothers who have been in such a leadership position to once again take lead and help us in a way that they did during the anti-war movement, for example, in Vietnam, against the anti-Vietnam war movement. So we're urging people to sign on, to endorse, and to help get the word out, and to change the way that we've been treated from charity cases or moochers to entitlement. This is money, our money, and we're entitled to it. And that will help us, I think, in the whole fight we're making now on the climate change environment, because it'll be bringing our resources towards the care of people and the planet.
We hadn't gotten to Eddie, and then we'll take some more questions. We have like 10 minutes.
In response to Nancy's question, I certainly hope that my hope in books or interventions or talking to people is that as many people as possible read it who haven't heard everything before. I hope that's the goal of all of us here. Now, whether that's actually the case, probably being too optimistic. But in terms of what one of the problematics with the book was, well, what are the politics of this ubiquitous apocalypse? Right, we're saturated in apocalyptic narratives and scenarios and films and so on. And so just sort of an inventory of the different politics of that, and there's different versions, all these millenarian religious versions, right-wing, xenophobic, racist versions, of course, liberal versions, and, of course, the environmental scenario, which, of course, is... If you're not adverse to that word, it is the real deal. It's the real apocalypse, right? But you know, what are the politics that emerge from becoming aware of the gravity of the crisis are not self-evident. So that would be, I suppose, part of the intervention. And I think part of it starts from this very simple pronoun of we, right? We often say we. I just said it, and I've heard even Doug say it. And you know, it's hard not to talk about we and us when we're talking about. You didn't say, yeah, right. That's right. It's getting there. Right, climate. Right. I mean, we're spaceship Earth. You know that we. You know, and I think that scientists, to their great credit, have basically, you know, tried to think of us as a species, and maybe not just humans. Think about all life on Earth as a species, and talk about we as this unity. And I think the great problem with this move is it's premature, right? It's asserting a premature unity of humanity at a moment when humanity is divided as it has been in the history of the planet, and it's divided along all sorts of lines, as we know, class, race, gender, geography, and they all intersect in complex ways. But the key dimension, of course, is power. It's a very uneven world. It's the climate crisis and all the environmental crises are experienced unevenly, and basically what I was saying earlier is that a lot of the climate politics on offer, which acknowledge the catastrophe and in fact will advocate for their policies based on that catastrophe, will in fact exacerbate those inequalities, will double down on them, will, in the name of the lifeboat ethics. Not everybody can be on the lifeboat of the spaceship Earth. So that's where we have, you know, the Malthusian story coming in, and it never goes away. That's when we have the substitution of new technologies, right, looking at a crisis not as a barrier to the system of growth and commodification, but in fact as a challenge to create new rounds of accumulation, to create new industries. Okay, and finally, and there's various examples we look at, but one of them is Y2K. If you remember Y2K, that was an interesting case, I think, of, you know, it was a sort of a wishful thinking of a kind of a apocalyptic end of the world, which was embraced by some on the left, some on the right, some, you know, back to the land people, and it, you know, what happened with that? Well, anyway.
So let me just make a couple of very quick comments, and we still have a few minutes left. We'll take your questions. I can see three people in line. In terms of electoral politics, I think it's putting the cart before the horse. My perspective is the left, and I define left as anti-capitalist. The role is to build powerful social movements and to engage in the state from that perspective. That's how you change things. I think it's extremely premature to be engaging in electoral politics. There are instances, Socialist Alternative has shown it could effectively do it in Seattle, but generally it's extremely not just difficult, I think it's counterproductive. In terms of the what can we do, I mean, there's a lot of ideas out there, you know, like cooperatives, worker-owned co-ops, but it's also problematic. They still operate in a market economy. I've visited with the folks, the Republic Windows and Doors people, repeatedly over the years and seen them go from idea to opening their new era windows, doors and factory. And their advantage is they can bring in costs lower than other capitalists because they have cut out the management layer, right? That's how they're doing it. So they're just more efficient capitalists.
Hi, I want to speak about community organizing. We were asked, we're going back to our homes and... Okay, and my name's Elizabeth Shanklin. During the women's movement, I went out to Chicago and I was trained as a community organizer. And I was thinking about that when we were talking here about, well, what should people do? Well, what we were taught, and it made perfectly good sense to me, was that they come with pain and they have a goal and they want to change something. So what we have to do ultimately is empower people in order to ultimately fight the state. It's going to be people power that can win because the corporations have the state power, and that's much more powerful than we are right now because people aren't mobilized. And so the issue arises, well, around what? But around what they feel, and the fact of them expressing what they feel together, they'll work it out. I remember an exercise we did was some people thought that they could just simply go and talk to the nice president of a corporation who would then make things right for their husbands or children who were working for that company. So we were sitting there, they really believed that. Well, we were taught, go with them, let them experience and learn what the reality is, and then they will move on. You can certainly give your opinion, but we have to mobilize people to think for themselves because that's what they don't want. Thank you.
Is this live? Yeah. I'm Bill Sweet. I'll try to do this really quick. A number of years ago, there was a review in the London Review of Books of a whole bunch of books about climate change, and the author, a British academic, made the observation that if all, you know, if everybody who really cared intensely and worried intensely about climate change were just to go outside, pick up a sharp rock, and deface the paint job on an SUV every time they saw an SUV, in very short order, it would be impossible for anybody on the face of the earth to drive an SUV. And I think implicitly he was asking the question, this doughty British academic, implicitly was sort of saying, how come people are not actually doing that? And so when Francis Fox Bevan was talking about the people blocking roads in South America, this came to mind. And I wanted to throw the question back to her. Do you actually think that people who care about climate ought to be adopting much more radical, direct tactics of some sort?
So my question is why we haven't heard more about the military's role in the destruction of our environment. And because it doesn't matter if we scratch up SUVs. It doesn't matter if we have high-speed rail. If we don't stop what the military is doing and the use of fossil fuels and all kinds of energy and fuels in the military, it does not matter. It's already happened in Iraq. Go to Fallujah. It's happened in Afghanistan. It's happening in Gaza. We've destroyed those parts of the planet and the people there, too. And that needs to be a big part of this discussion.
Hi, my name is Mary, and I'm from Chicago. And this is not so much a question to you, but just an idea to throw out. I probably couldn't do this particular suggestion because I don't have the technological knowledge. But I'm going to suggest that if there was a website where all of us, coming from our many diverse backgrounds and knowledge and expertise and ideas and creativity, could sign on under a single unifying vision, something simple, not easy, but something simple that many people from every part of the planet could log onto and say, okay, I'm doing this locally. I'm for this single unifying vision, and I'm doing this because we all have so many wonderful creative ideas, and we're motivated by many, many things, but we can't say, oh, we can't, I think we don't have the time to go, oh, this is better, this is better, this is better, this is better, we should do this, we should do this, we should do this. No, we should, under one single unifying vision, do all the wonderful creative things that I know how to do, that you know how to do, that you know how to do. Thank you.
So there was a question earlier about, you know, recommendations, and that this, I think, maybe ties into this militarization question, which you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of things didn't get talked about, and that's a huge one, right? The role of the military in all of this, and the increasing militarization that we're seeing, whether it's in Ferguson or any other parts of the world, domestically, externally, which if our imagination fails us and we continue to imagine the end of the world rather than the end of capitalism and militarism, it's going to look like that. That's going to be the solution that's on offer. And so my suggestion to be prepared is basically be prepared as climate activists, as eco-socialists, as human rights activists, as whatever we are, to that whenever an issue occurs that doesn't appear to immediately be about climate, to think, well, how is it, in fact, about climate? Because, again, I don't think the climate crisis will manifest itself as a climate all the time. So even Ferguson, you know, I was reading those old Riot Commission reports, the Kerner Commission. They always talked about the long, hot summer, right? They want to have this climactic determinism for rioting. Well, we're going to have longer and hotter summers, you know, combined with many generations of neoliberal policy. That's real, right? We see, of course, with Ebola, what is the relationship of the IMF and the World Bank's policies and destroying the health infrastructure of Africa. But again, there could be a piece there. So I think that be prepared. And so when the next crisis, you know, thing that's seen as a crisis, whether it's a Sandy or a Katrina or the drought, even a slow motion thing, be prepared and be ready so that when you start to see the more pernicious versions of explanation on offer, oh, it's too many people, it's the immigrants, you know, something like that. No, we've been looking at this, and when this is predicted, it's not going to surprise us, unfortunately. So be prepared.
You know, it's not mainly a problem of public opinion. So it's not mainly a problem of talking to people about whether or not they're in favor of global warming. They're not. Or whether they're in favor of species extinction. They're not. They don't want the seas to rise. There is more and more evidence that the American public isn't in favor of most of the policies that are promoted by our governments. So it's a problem of acting to interfere with those governments and interfere with the carbon industry. So to the person who asked whether we need more radical tactics, obviously we need more radical tactics soon.
Doug? Yeah, just picking up from that, direct action is wonderful. I think this is such a complicated and profound issue that we need it all. I mean, we need scientists doing science. We need tamer sorts doing traditional political organizing. We need writers writing, speakers speaking, teachers teaching, and people chaining themselves to bulldozers and scratching SUVs and all those things. All the above. And I think it's just a matter of practical politics. Unless there's a really crazy wing that scares the hell out of the ruling class, then nobody's even listened to the mildest reformist. So even just in terms of getting things done, you need some real hardcore people to as a source of energy and fear. Fear up there,
yeah,
not
right.
Abroad.
Yes. Thank you all for coming. Time is up. I know Doug and Francis have to run.